Ever wonder if there's more to the movies you love? Do you like to ponder how they got from A to Z? Who chose the plot twists? Why use those characters? Is there a deeper meaning? We're here to explore those questions and maybe learn a bit along the way. VGB Studios proudly presents The Filmlosophers.
If I told you about her, what would I say? Perhaps I would just warn you about the tale of love and loss and the monster who tried to destroy it all. If I spoke about it, what would I tell you?
Hello and welcome to another exciting episode of The Filmlosophers, the show that gets into the movies you love and digs a little deeper. I am your host, Eddie Villanueva, and alongside me, as always, is Sir Chad Beast from Within Riley.
I brought my flippers.
You brought your flippers?
I don't know.
We got a great show.
I was supposed to say.
We got a great show in store for you, and we can't wait to start talking about the movie, so stay tuned. The Filmlosophers are presented by Mingle Media TV and recorded live in an aquatic holding tank each week at VGB Studios.
See?
I see what you did there. You can swim through our entire
libraries. Those
are my
bubble voices.
Is that what that was?
Yeah. They're pretty good.
It was, yeah. You can swim through our entire library with Chad's flippers on Google Play, Libsyn, Stitcher, Player FM, Audio Boom, or iTunes any day of the week. Then, once you're caught up, new episodes debut each Wednesday. Whether you go with the flow or like to be countercultural, conversation is always welcome on our social pages. Like the show on Facebook at facebook.com/filmlosophers and follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/filmlosophy101. Last but not least, you can access all of our previous episodes at vgbstudios.com alongside other amazing podcasts like Video Game Bang, and me, Mike, Self, and I. I think we've gotten into a really good rhythm of being able to say a lot of those things, because before we were always like, me, myth, and...
I was going to say, I was very proud just now with your enunciation.
Thank you.
Or pronunciation. I can never remember. You gave a very clear k at Mike, Self.
I tried. I did. And speaking of try, we are actually going to be throwing down a awesome review of a film that is debuting this Friday from the man, the myth, the legend, the one and only Guillermo del Toro. Yes.
Guillermo del Toro? Did you just roll your...
I added a double...
Did you just A-yay the L-A?
Yes, sir. We are talking about The Shape of Water. The film debuts this Friday.
That, folks, is passion. Passion.
You sounded like a perfume commercial.
You sounded like a perfume commercial.
Hey, I mean, what can I say?
This music sounds like a perfume commercial.
It does.
I feel like I'm listening to the audio from a Chanel. Like one of those, you know, those weird ones. Sorry, this is total sidetrack. No? Those high-end perfume commercials, I never get them.
I usually, you know what the sad thing is that every time, so I don't like them at all, but I hate them even worse when they incorporate a really good actor or actress that I actually enjoy.
Which is most of the time.
And then I think a little bit less of that particular actor or actress. I'm like, come on, Charlize Theron, you could have done better than doing this commercial. Johnny Depp, of course, I could understand.
Well,
the man... Yeah, but...
Par for the course over there.
But everybody else, come on. They just looped in Julia Roberts in one recently, and it's
right.
Just god-awful. So...
You know what? I think they'd be better if they were directed by...
Guillermo del Toro. Ah, that's right. So, as we said, we're discussing The Shape of Water. We got a chance to see the film, and now that it is available to talk about, because it is debuting this Friday, we couldn't wait to... quote, dive in.
You just said that like an NPR person on on SNL. To, quote, dive in. Oh, it's going to be a good show, y'all.
The premise of the film, Eliza is a mute, isolated woman who works as a cleaning lady in a hidden high-security government laboratory in 1962 Baltimore. Her life changes forever when she discovers the lab's classified secret, a mysterious scaled creature from South Africa that lives...
South America.
South America, not South Africa, South America, that lives in a water tank. As Eliza develops a unique bond with her new friend, she soon learns that its fate and very survival lies in the hands of a hostile government agent and a marine biologist. Directed by... Yes, we're going to go through this one more time. The
one
illustrious
more time.
Genius...
This is happening the whole episode, people. Just get used to it.
Guillermo del Toro. The film stars Sally Hawkins, Michael Shannon, Octavia Spencer, Richard Jenkins, and the master of creature acting, Doug Jones. Currently, the film is holding at a 95% fresh rating, so kudos. Guillermo del Toro said about Sally Hawkins.
I'm just looking at the notes that you've prepared for this episode, and his name is absolutely everywhere.
Littered. Yes.
Sorry, he said something about Sally
Hawkins. He said about Sally
Hawkins, the main performer.
Not only was she the first choice, she was the only choice. I wrote the movie for Sally. Which is super cool to hear that this prolific director went out of his way to create a film that he actually put other major motion pictures off to the side for to finish this one. And he had somebody in mind when he was creating it.
Well, and it's not like, it's not like Sally Hawkins has not done anything.
No.
But she's not a major star. Like, she's not like a Julia Roberts.
No.
Or I only use that example because of
we just
the
mentioned
perfume commercial reference. She's not really doing a whole lot.
No.
Movie-wise anymore. She doesn't have to. But, you know, Sally Hawkins is not like necessarily the Jennifer Lawrence.
No.
Of our current time, you know, that people would say, oh, yeah, I totally, dozens of people want to write movies for that performer specifically. I think it's high praise, quite the compliment that he had her and only her in mind for this film, and he wrote the part specifically for her to perform.
And we'll talk a little bit as to how she adds her unique and special flair to the role as we dive in. Guillermo del Toro has worked on this film for several years and developed it before he began production on Pacific Rim in 2013. Eventually, he chose to direct this film instead of Pacific Rim Uprising, which will be debuting next year. He began working on the film in 2011, self-financing a crew that designed both the creature and the lab. The film overall took 9 months. It actually took over 9 months to arrive at the look of the creature, and Del Toro calls it the most difficult movie he and his team have ever designed. There's a lot of visuals that make this film, obviously because you have somebody who's a mute, so you have to kind of rely more on the visual aspect.
Sure.
But there's a lot of great, unique visuals in this film that add a lot of depth to the certain scenes that, you know, transpire, you know, in the film. So obviously, when he says that he, you know, it was the most difficult movie, I can understand it after seeing everything that we saw in the film.
Well, and it starts really right at the beginning. I mean, you're kind of the way that the cinematography works, at the very least. You don't see the creature right away. You see the creature a little later. But the cinematography for the film, I felt almost like I was getting ready to ride 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea at Disney World. Well, Disneyland, I guess, here in California. I grew up going to Disney World in Florida, but I'm sure that there's a 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea in California, right?
What is that?
Okay, never mind. There isn't. So
I mean, I know what the book is.
So
but
there was a ride at Disney World in Florida that you had like a you were in a submersible and you saw things on the sides and through the bottom, and you know you went under the sea.
I think
and
they changed that for the Finding Nemo ride.
The colors and the textures and just the whole ambiance of the beginning sequence of this film really, it makes you feel almost like you're underwater. You're not. I mean, she lives above a movie theater. An aging movie theater that's not very well attended, but the way that the lighting and the everything works, it makes you almost feel like you're underwater already.
Yeah, if you were paying attention in the TV spot that we tend to play TV spots before we jump into the show. In the TV spot, there was a little bit of a narration done by Richard Jenkins. Sorry, I was looking at Octavia Spencer and Richard Jenkins. Richard Jenkins, and that narration is actually at the beginning of the film,
mm-hmm.
Uniquely enough, and that is happening while this scene that Chad is talking about, where it's all very water-esque. Everything is kind of just flooded in water. It's like a very underwater-type filmed scene.
Which yeah, I mean, sure definitely the opening scene. You're underwater.
Yeah.
You're in an apartment and you're underwater, and it's very stylized. But even beyond that point, much of the first, I would say, probably 5 minutes or so of the film definitely ushers you into that space, that mindset. I mean, I've never actually been submerged in a submarine out in the open sea, but you know, it's just that feeling of almost being surrounded by fluidity,
mm-hmm.
And that kind of the bright darkness, you know, of like light filtered through water.
Yeah,
you kind of have this bright darkness in a lot of the opening sequences or opening scenes within the opening sequence.
So as we said, we got a chance to see this movie, and of course, me being a really big fan of the director, of just him in general, I'd say I'm an okay fan. I'm just a decent fan, but the man has done no wrong in my eyes. Let's just be honest, and I don't think he's done wrong ever to anybody. So you know, that's just my take on the man.
Hopefully not. I mean, this day and age in Hollywood, if he's done wrong to somebody, he gone.
Or it'll surface sometime soon.
And he should be. I'm not saying that in a trite way to say that people who do things wrong to people should not be gone.
No doubt.
They should be gone.
Yes, very
but hopefully,
true.
Because he's such a talented director. And gets a lot of acclaim. He puts a lot of heart into...
He does.
And a lot of focus into his projects. So hopefully he will continue to be the creative genius that he's been thus far.
This film... So as we jump into this film, the interesting thing about this movie is that this was definitely one that I had actually been looking forward to most of the year. So we had talked about it ever since the trailers debuted before Comic-Con and everything, and people were talking about it. It looked like it was going to be Guillermo del Toro's follow-up, next big follow-up to his previous adult fairy tale, if you will, Pan's Labyrinth. This was going to be the next one that was going to not so much bring him back to form where he was at when that film was made, but to be like a continuation of that creativity. And so for me hearing that, for me seeing that and what it could possibly be, I got excited. I'm a huge fan of the movie Pan's Labyrinth. I think it's a beautiful movie. I think it's a very well done story in how it's told and in the setting and the harsh reality of certain instances in the film. And you can certainly see through the trailers how much of that influences this movie as well. So kind of coming into the movie before we even started seeing it, I was very excited and scared at the same time, because as much as I loved Pan's Labyrinth and I was hoping to see something that brought me back to that place where I first saw it, I was also worried that, much like any movie that we see that tends to be hyped up really well and everybody talks about it and everybody in the artistic mindset in terms of critics who saw it is like raving about and everything, you think, okay, it's got to be great. It's going to be great. It's going to be awesome. It's going to be wonderful. It's going to be the best thing ever. But then, like I said, much like most things that get hyped, if they don't meet that expectation, how far is it going to fall from grace? You know? So when we were about to watch it, I was kind of going through like that whole angel on one side, devil on one side, like, oh, it's going to be great. Don't worry about anything. It's going to be wonderful. You're just going to enjoy the movie. Just go and see it. Blah, blah,
well,
blah.
Let's be honest. We've had moments in the past where there was a healthy expectation
mm-hmm.
in a positive sense. And within moments of the movie starting, you've got that gut sinking kind of like, oh no, this is not going to be what I hope it is.
Yeah, and that was essentially my mindset, my heart, like my stomach, because I was wanting to be able to fall in love with everything that other people were falling in love with about this movie. You know, people.
Well,
were,
not to mention, I mean, Guillermo del Toro is your dude.
He is, and I have, like I said, I'm not speaking anything that's like just a hype about the man. There has yet to be a movie that he's done that I have not liked. From all the way from when he did Kronos back in the early 90s to the Hellboy movies to even with his most recent movie, Crimson Peak, I thought it was good. He is a very unique storyteller and a very unique visionary when it comes to creating movies. And so when, like I said, the first mention of, oh, this is a return to form from Pan's Labyrinth, this is going to make you feel like that again, you're going to, you know, blah, blah, blah. It worried me, you know, much like if we ever come back to, and I say this because I know how much this particular movie means to you.
Oh,
but
boy.
It's like if the Ridley Scott decided to come out with another movie and early critics got to see it and they're like, oh my gosh, it's a return to form with Gladiator. It's another Gladiator movie and it's another one of these ones. It's so great, it might even be better than Gladiator.
And oh boy.
And it's a lot of hype and it's a lot of talk. And as much as you know the director and as much as you love his work and as much as you'd love to see something that surpasses the movie that ultimately made you fall in love with the creative mind behind this film, it's also a little scary because then what if it doesn't make the mark? What if it doesn't get exactly where it's trying to go?
Sure. I mean, I would definitely be like in the movie theater. I would look like those old, you know, the Three Stooges sketch where the guy puts his hand in between his eyes because he knows that the poke is coming. That's the way I would watch a movie like that. I totally understand what you're saying.
Because yeah.
I'd be like, no, I want to see this and I want to love it, but if you happen to reach to poke me in the eyes with whatever you've made, then I'm not going to let it happen.
Exactly.
Because exactly. you don't want to miss in the present day to tarnish your memory of the greatness of the thing that you love from the past.
Oh, no doubt. Exactly.
Man,
exactly.
Somebody should put that on a coffee mug. Oi. It's a really long phrase, though.
It really is. It wrap around at least three times, and you're like,
it's
wait.
It's okay. You know, it's deep. It means something.
I'm still turning the mug. Hold on.
So going into the film,
yeah,
your expectation level was high, but so was your anxiety in a way.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Because like I said, I'm all kidding aside, I am a huge fan of his work because of his approach to storytelling, his ability to create a childlike emote, like these childlike feelings in a very grown and adult atmosphere in a film. Even with his horror films to his more non-horror-ish type films like Pan's Labyrinth and so forth, even having fun with things like Hellboy and all that, he just has that ability. So, like I said, with this film, I wanted it to be exactly what the people had hyped it up to be.
Well, I think one of the things that's really impressive about his particular body of work is, for the most part, even including, you know, a film like Pacific Rim, which is much more blockbustery, computer graphics instead of creature effects and all of that, he's always had a particular skill for bringing a sense of brightness, hope, and purpose in spite of a very dark, muted color palette most of the time.
Yeah.
Some grotesque creature designs. You know, things that are not attractive. Finding attractive elements within non-attractive visuals. Visuals that would turn most people off. You know, like, I mean, you know, Pan's Labyrinth. The guy had eyeballs in the palms of his hands. You know, some of them had like razor teeth, and they looked like demons.
Yeah,
you know, like they looked like scary figures, but not all of them were. Here, you've got this amphibious creature, presumably male.
Yeah.
You know, sort of like, you know, the creature from the Black Lagoon or something like that. Something in that. Side of the genre, and you've got a dark research facility. You know, it's a government-funded research facility in the '60s. So, of course, obviously, all the lights have to be at like 40% power. Yeah. And all the colors are drab, the uniforms, the floors. It's all not much to look at. And yet, the way that it's presented and the storytelling that is being done, there is much to look at.
Oh, yeah.
But it's definitely not like a... It's not an overt brightness, you know? You've got a lot of limitations to the characters and the story. I mean, the main character, Sally Hawkins' character, is mute, so she can sign, and she can emote, like, with facial expressions and whatnot.
Yeah.
She doesn't speak. People speak to her, or they speak for her. The creature doesn't speak a language per se. It makes noises that could be language in its mm-hmm. in its way, and so there has to be a way of communicating established at some point. You know, you've got a lot of dark colors, a lot of nighttime scenes, a lot of rain, and other water imagery. All of it works together as a piece, but at the same time, you got all this hardship, if you will, to overcome, and yet from the get-go, for the most part, it's fairly charming. I mean, that little French bit that you worked into the opening sequence of our podcast is like the opening musical number of the film, from what I can recall.
Yeah.
Like, it's a background, you know, a background number, but it's this charming, like, I don't know, Parisian bistro kind of music, which is fun.
Yeah. And the great thing is that this film, although it takes place in Baltimore, it has that very much, you know, mid-century French feel to it, like that film noir, French film noir type
sure.
vibe with the type of music that it's playing and the way this, the even the architecture from the apartments to the way the theater is built, you know, to the way the it seems like everything outside of the laboratory is very much in that whimsical type French architecture structure. Even, you know, obviously some of the cars are more American, but just the streets and whatnot, that seems very much in that vein.
Yeah, it's definitely, it has the feel, even though it's set in the early 60s, it still has the feel of a throwback even mm-hmm. beyond that time frame.
So, as we started seeing the film, like Chad said, you're introduced to Eliza, who is the mute, very, very introvert type woman. She's to herself very much. She's almost like a creature of habit. She has a certain certain
routine
that she has in the morning, and when she, you know, when she gets to work, she's always late, but her friend is always there holding her space. And but you meet her, and there's a certain type of unique presence that Sally Hawkins brings to this particular character, because as much as you're watching somebody who has no ability to speak, her interaction with just about everything, from merely taking off her hat to use it as a pillow while on the bus, to her interacting with her friend who is just going on and on and on, talking mm-hmm. the entire night, and Eliza not saying anything, but her reacting to it, it's very expressive. She's very much in every scene that she's in without having to actually announce verbally her presence.
Right.
Which I think is a very unique quality for this actress. I mean, that really says so much about somebody whose presence, even if it is a very back burner type of character, somebody who'd rather be behind.
Yeah, she's a bit of a wallflower.
She
you
is.
Know, and not just because she's mute and unable to speak, but her mannerisms, the way that she relates to other characters,
yeah.
She has a wallflower personality as well.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And so, like we said, she is interacting constantly with Octavia Spencer, who is her friend, the other cleaning woman at the time. And we did mention this is during 1962 Baltimore, so this is during the height of the civil rights movement, and a lot of things were beginning to transpire. This was around the time when I believe Kennedy had been assassinated. So I believe this was after the fact. there's a mention at the beginning when
I'm looking at you right now, like I'm so impressed, because for the first half of this movie I had no clue where it was set or when it was set. I must have missed something along the way. They do eventually, I know they eventually say Baltimore very prominently, and I'm like, oh, yeah, that's where this is supposed to be. I didn't know until I looked at your notes that it was supposed to be 1962. Eventually, one of the characters goes to a car dealership, and you kind of can get some references there. But
yeah, well, like in the introduction, in that narration intro, mm-hmm, there's a longer part of it. The little piece that we had in the beginning, that's just a piece of it. But in the larger part, he talks about how there was a queen who was coming to an end of her reign, and things of that sort, and which didn't make sense to me until after the fact, that when I started looking at it. And that's around the time when, you know, obviously Jackie Onassis Kennedy was about to leave the White House because of no longer being the wife of the president, because the president passed.
Yeah, I didn't pick up on that at all.
And so...
I believe you. I know it's there. It was so fairy tale esque, mm-hmm, like that opening narration.
Yeah.
From Richard Jenkins. It is
you
very
sure it's
fairy
not
tale.
Spencer?
I'm very sure. Well, I mean, I guess I'm as sure as these notes that you've prepared for us to talk through. But and the one thing that did stand out to me from the opening narration, mm-hmm, was, you know, it has the part that you had included in the beginning of the show where, you know, the two characters, you know, the two characters fighting to communicate or whatever it says, mm-hmm, and the monster coming between them. And of course you're thinking, well, the amphibious water creature is the monster, but clearly it's not him. He's not the monster. Michael Shannon's character is the monster.
Yeah. And speaking of Michael Shannon, well, let's take an even further step back. So going back to Octavia Spencer is very much a loud character. She's almost like a combination between her role in The Help and her role in what was that movie that was earlier this year in February?
Hidden Figures. Yeah.
It was like a combination of those.
Similar. It's a very similar character. Yeah. Very similar, actually.
So you have her role, and then we mentioned Richard...
Jenkins.
Yeah, see, you remembered. Richard Jenkins.
I never forgot in the first place, my friend.
You have his...
He's the neighbor across the hall.
He is literally right smack next to her door as the hallway kind of comes to a point, which is so funny from a visual standpoint. You look down the hall and you see two doors. But he is the closeted gay next-door neighbor who is an artist.
Yeah, he used to work for like an advertising, mm-hmm, agency as one of their in-house artists and was ousted, or, you know, something happened. And so now he works on contract, and he watches, you know, television programs and feeds his cats and paints. And that's pretty much it.
Yeah. And then, of course, as we were talking about the monster, talking about Michael Shannon's character as he's introduced, he's very much, and it was funny because after we saw the film, I turned to Chad and I'm like, I really get a similar vibe between his role and the general's role from Pan's Labyrinth, the very narcissistic, chauvinist type of persona that believes he is right, and because he's a man, he is entitled more than any other person in the entire world, especially from women. And so that's very much an apparent personality with Michael Shannon's character, as he plays this government agent who just comes in and takes over that entire project. Oh, not takes
yeah, you don't
over,
even
but,
really know what the laboratory does.
No.
Like, you don't know what the facility is about at all, apart from when the creature arrives and he arrives with it. He's the leader of the team that has brought the creature to this facility.
And it's instantaneous. It's like as the opening scenes are still transpiring, the introduction of Michael Shannon and the creature in its containment unit is still within like the first 10 minutes of the film.
Right.
So you have that immediate introduction with that. But Michael Shannon's character is very... I don't know. I'm I'm on the fence with his character, and for one or two reasons. Number one, as much as Michael Shannon really knows how to play a jerk or a bad guy, and I'm not saying he is one, it's just that every time we see him in films, more popular films, he tends to play the antagonist. And like
often,
yeah. Mm-hmm. And so in this role, it seemed like he was playing that role, but the role was the typical like government agent jerk. Like he could have been played by the guy who was in The Iron Giant, and it would have been the same. But the fact that it was Michael Shannon, and Michael Shannon adds,
you know, the guy in The Iron Giant was animated, right?
Yeah, it's true. But
okay,
I'm just making sure. Have you never seen Cool World? I mean, come on. Cartoons and live animation combined.
I thought it was worth pointing out.
So yeah, Michael Shannon's character is in this, and he is a like I said, he's the jerk government agent who comes in. He is over everything. Everything goes through him. If anything, you know, happens, it's because he says so, and he's going to get the commendations.
Yeah, he's got the ear of a five-star general, and he's using this as a stepping stone in his career.
True. And of course, you get the introduction, slight introduction of the creature. The great thing about, and I'll just kind of leave this right here, and then we'll probably revisit it later. The great thing about the creature is that you know this creature is an actual, like, physical creature. It's not a CGI'd, person. It's not an actual person in a suit.
Moments that they did enhance things with, you know,
with the help of CGI.
CGI, but yes, it is a performer in costume on set with the actual lighting performing with the other people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
yeah, and that's one of the things that I think is a really great mark of directing, and especially with Guillermo del Toro. One of his trademarks is utilizing practical effects in most of his films to add that realism and that added texture of you know, the realism in the worlds that he creates. So I really admire about what he does and what he did in this film.
I would agree. I mean, the creature design, to hear that it took 9 months for them to get that design right. I mean, it that's just, number one, telling of their dedication to their craft, and number two, explains why it comes out looking so good, like so believable.
And not only did it take 9 months, but he, like we said, he financed the entire team who designed that, so he was paying out of his own pocket everything that it took to create this creature the way it looks now. So, you know, kudos to the director, right?
Sure. I mean,
but yeah. But beyond characters, another really great part of the film was seeing how Del Toro like was able to visualize a lot of the cinematography in the film, the way he structured scenes. Like you were saying, the 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. I was thinking that, but every time they were in that one laboratory room where the creature was being held, like with all the pipes and all the rust and everything, it was like being back at watching those types of movies, you know, seeing the way all these pipes just go all over the place. Some of them have these little portholes that you can, with glass, that you can see the water and you can see this. And it was very, very like interesting. Like, I'm trying to think of another word to describe it, but it was just really cool to see how someone's just looking at a room and they're like, all right, this is what we're gonna do, and then boom 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 boom, and is able to create such scenes like that.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely has kind of that almost the like the famous Scooby-Doo cartoon with the diving suit.
Oh, yeah.
That's not got anybody in it, and, you know, whatever, and it's like the glowing ghost diving suit thing.
Yes.
And, it's that kind of aesthetic. It's like old nautical. Like, it would have been old in 1962.
Mm-hmm.
Which is when the film is apparently set, according to you.
Yes, sir.
So it has this age to it, like you mentioned, dark, rusty. You know, it's not to say that this is a government facility is not the same as saying that it's all top of the line.
Yeah.
Pristine and everything looks nice and crisp and fresh. It doesn't. It looks run down, honestly. Yeah.
It almost looks like this is the equivalent to a dirty dungeon at a prison.
Very much so.
You know, and for what it is used for, it pretty much is. For the laboratory, it is the dungeon for this particular creature who is locked up in this place. So I think the visual parallel with equating the grunge and the rust and the way all the pipes are twisted and mangled all over the place and the way this creature is chained up is very similar to, you know, like being in a prison cell, like a very old prison cell.
And I love how the way that the story is built, the way that the film was conceived forces you to pay attention to the detail work. Because,
oh, yeah.
I mean, essentially, yes, you have Octavia Spencer, who is a bit of a motor mouth in many of the scenes that she's in.
Mm-hmm.
And it's charming and, you know, it's fun to watch her do that. Michael Shannon has quite a bit of dialogue that he covers in the film. There are a few other characters we haven't mentioned yet. But really, your two leads are Sally Hawkins and, what is it, Doug Jones?
Doug Jones.
And they're both basically mute. They don't have speaking lines proper.
Yeah.
He makes noises sometimes and mostly does actions. And she uses sign language sometimes that is subtitled for you most of the time, unless there's a character there telling you presumably what she said. Or she's using her expressions. And it's really interesting, the lack of verbal auditory communication two ways, either with each of them solo or between the two of them once they start interacting with each other. It does really invite you to notice all of the detail work that goes into the sets, the costumes, the lighting, the cinematography, all of that.
Yeah.
Notice it a lot more in this movie because you're not distracted by dialogue. And
no.
I'm saying that as a word nerd. I love dialogue. I love listening to people in movies talk and to hear if it's, you know, poetic or grungy or whatever it might be. But here you've got communication happening for sure. There is communication happening between the characters even when it's not verbal. But the fact that it's not verbal really helps you pick up on some of the other things that are – right there for you to appreciate about the movie making part of the movie.
Yeah, it kind of speaks to that that kind of old adage that some people say, you know, how if you lose one sense that the other ones will kind of take up the slack and intensify and, you know, and allow you to, you know, just really work through that with that ability. And I think with this film, in every scene where these two are interacting and they're on screen and they're having, you know, they're engaging with each other, that those scenes are some of the most visual scenes that he's done in a long while. They're the most vibrant scenes, or they're the most complex, with, you know, whether if it's the water that's nearby or seeing the way the large tank of water that's right next to her while she's eating lunch, you know, and he comes up and pulls an egg, or you know, the dynamic of where they're at speaks more volumes than just the mere interaction of the two in the scene by themselves. And I think that's one of the things that really stands out for this film, is that in each and every one of those, you find yourself almost in like a Where's Waldo state, where you're looking at them, but then you notice the slight clink of the chains as it's moving off to the left, or you're in a scene where those two are standing next to each other, but you also notice, you know, the way the mirror begins to slowly fog up as they're, you know, in the bathroom or whatever it may be, you notice a lot of the smaller and more minute pieces that Guillermo del Toro is putting together to create this incredible scene.
Well, and really, I mean, you have a story that could easily become, you know, creature feature commodified in a way.
True.
You know,
that
doesn't really even try to accomplish the detail work. It's easy to make a film that has a compelling hook and some unique characterization and conflict, mm-hmm. and you just kind of skate through the whole thing, and you don't really include a lot of detail because the audience doesn't necessarily require it. People can appreciate it when it's there, but they're mm-hmm. not necessarily going in for this richly detailed textured experience. They're going for character or they're going for plot. And one of the things that's amazing about this film and much of his filmography, mm-hmm. Del Toro. His filmography is that you have the details. Mm-hmm. You've got a compelling plot, you've got interesting characters, and you have all of this rich, especially the textures and the colors and the lighting. Mm-hmm. Just rich, rich detail. You've got a character, Michael Shannon, his character gets into an altercation that you don't see with the fish man. I don't know exactly what to call him. He doesn't have a name. But the creature, you see the aftermath. The aftermath is the creature has bitten or sliced off two of his fingers. Mm-hmm. And the fingers are recovered and surgically put back on Michael Shannon's character's hand. And then throughout the entire rest of the film, the condition of the reattached fingers changes slowly over time. Uh-huh. And it's always there for you to notice. It's never focused on. The camera's not saying, look at this right now, until it becomes important later in the movie. But it's there for you to see. It's mm-hmm. it's at the bottom of the frame or on the side of the frame or whatever. Like anytime you're seeing the bandaged hand, you can, on your own volition, by your own choice, pay attention to the fact that they are changing the condition of the fingers over time.
And it's a facet of every scene that he's in. It's a slow transition, but yet, like you said, once it gets to the point to where it is important to recognize this, you soon forget that, oh, that was actually a part of the whole film. Like, you begin to re-remember the scenes past, and you're like, oh yeah, that's right. He did have... This was getting worse and worse as the film continued. And those types of subtle pieces, the importance played on those things is really the mark of you know, great storytelling. You know, you have somebody who is used to being more visual. His films are very visual, not used to, but he is a very visual director. He's a very very much look at the picture more than the center. You know, look at the wide rather than just the narrow. And, you know, in every single one of his films, he focuses on that, where when you least expect it, Crimson Peak is a great example. When you least expect it, something else is in the screen that you should have paid attention to, that you should have focused. And by mm-hmm. the time that is now the focus, you've missed out on the opportunity of watching that transpire and it translate over from becoming from the background to the foreground. And that's one of those things where you recognize with this film that the most smallest and minute of little things that are going on in the film are some of the most beautiful and well-done things that you should be focusing on. Case in point, I was thinking about it while you were talking. One of the most beautiful scenes that are in the film is a simple scene where Eliza is on the bus. And she is leaving her Aquaman, if you will, at the apartment. She's going to work, but as she's sitting there and she's looking out the window, she's noticing these two raindrops that are on the window, and the raindrops begin to circle around, and it's almost like they begin to dance around, mm-hmm. and her finger follows them, and you as a camera are just zoomed in so tight. But a couple seconds before, it was a wide shot, and you weren't really paying attention to any of the water droplets. You were focused on her. But then, as you know, as she's moving her fingers, the focus begins to change to the outside window, where you're seeing these water droplets begin to dance around. And like I said, as it follows, it's a very beautifully done scene. But those types of things, those types of little things where who would think to put emphasis on a couple of raindrops that are on a window of a bus and watch them dance, as it being a parallel to her wishing she could dance with the Aquaman, you know, like that.
Yeah, I mean, you gave away a fairly significant plot point when you said that he's in her apartment. There does come a time, which was forecast in the trailer, so I don't think it's a big deal, a bit of a spoil, but there does come a time where there's a jailbreak, if you will.
Yes.
She and others are able to work together to free him from the government facility, and then the government yes. agents are looking, trying to find, like, who did this? Where is he? It? Where are they? There's a whole subplot with the KGB
yes.
and, you know, Russian colluders, you know, within the facility
mm-hmm.
In collusion with the Russian government, secret agents, if you will. You know, so there's a bit of spy play. It's not a huge component of the film,
no.
but there's enough to warrant a mention.
Yeah.
You know, and honestly, it leads to some interesting character interactions and interesting alliances.
True.
Midway through the film,
and I think this is another, and mind you, the only reason why I reference this so much is because this film was heralded as a return to this film in terms of its form and its creativity and design. But another parallel between this one and Pan's Labyrinth, as we're talking, is the idea of, you know, two warring groups, if you will, and the ultimate assistance of one group to help the person stuck in the middle succeed in an instance. And
well, and really, I mean, there's a beautiful there's a really interesting decision that's made by one of these figures to put the government agenda aside. So mm-hmm. the whole idea of, you know, because it's Cold War era, yeah. You know, so spycraft in a Cold War sense, and there's a distinct, you know, there's what the American government wants, there's what the Russian government wants, and then there's another way, right?
Yeah.
And I think that it's a beautiful parallel, if you were to take it so far.
Yeah.
There's a beautiful parallel to decisions that many of us face in small ways any and every day. You know, like here's the big, you know, nationalistic movement of thought, ideology, right? And here's another one that's opposed, and so you think that it's either this or that, and you don't look for a third way. But that doesn't mean there isn't another way. You know,
True.
That doesn't mean there isn't another answer. And here in this film, you've got what the Americans want, what the embedded sleeper cell Russian people want, and then you've got what your conscience is telling you to do, right? Which is lot of what Eliza represents, because she has multiple. Her path is set, and even those closest to her aren't able to get on board with her at first. They don't understand why she's making the choices she's making. She has a whole argument with her neighbor friend, and he's basically walking away from her. I can't do this. And then she bangs on the wall as he's retreating. Like, she hits the wall to get his attention because, again, she's mute. She doesn't make noise. She has some kind of an injury on her neck that has damaged her vocal cords irreparably. And so she bangs on the wall to get his attention and you know, make one last argument. He walks away anyway. And then for other reasons becomes involved again shortly thereafter. But, you know, it's a great way of kind of I don't know, showing the dreamer inside all of us, society may tell you you've got one of two options. But who's to say there's not a third, a fourth, a fifth, a sixth, a seventh? Like, who's to say that, you know, following maybe that voice in your core that doesn't even come out, it can't even express itself, right? Yeah. Hers can't. That voice that can't really verbalize itself, if you follow it, sometimes it's going to lead you to some really important decisions that no one else could have led you to make. And that's a pretty cool, you know, a pretty cool takeaway to get from her journey.
Oh, yeah, completely. I mean, and that's one of the great things about this film and other films that he does. And mind you, I know I refer back constantly to the director, and as great as he is, I know there's other collaborators that are a part of this film, other writers, other individuals who, you know, are a part of visually creating and executing this vision, you know, to create the film that we saw. But that's, for me, that's one of the great things about this type of filmmaking, is it's a movie that still holds true to what film used to be about, and that was to leave you with an experience that changes you, that gives you a reason to change, that reminds you as to how important change is, how much moving away from the status quo of what life is and can be and will be if you stay stagnant, you know, moving away from that and being open to whatever the future holds and you know, reaching for it and jumping for it, and you know, and I think that type of filmmaking has gotten lost over the last few years, and many people are more enthralled with stories that have already been told. And not to say that there's an issue with it, but it's just, it's a type of filmmaking, it's a style of filmmaking, that's fine. But when you go back to that style of filmmaking, you typically find it with children's films or cartoons, you know, things like that, or fairy tales, films that are meant to inspire a younger audience. And that's why Guillermo del Toro, with his ability to create what many have called adult fairy tales, it brings us back to that mindset. It brings us back to the place where we can actually watch a film and still draw a lesson from it while being adults. We don't have to see, you know, oh, okay, Bugs Bunny didn't do that because he wanted to be nice to Elmer Fudd, and so blah, blah, blah. Oh, great, okay, had to watch a cartoon to see that. No, you're actually seeing a film that is translating as a fairy tale while still allowing people to be changed and altered in terms of thinking about their own life and thinking about the world around them.
Yeah, it's interesting. I do like that you've brought us back to that terminology, adult fairy tale, because I did have an issue with this film. And I know you know what I'm talking about.
I know exactly what you're talking about.
This, for all of the appreciation that that I can share, that you have shared about, you know, the details in the film, the storyline, the interesting characters, what ultimately happens. Like, there's a lot that's really fulfilling. It's truly, it feels like truly a unique original story in an age in Hollywood where you don't necessarily get a lot of those. Even the art house films and the Oscar winners oftentimes are, you know, based on a real life story that has been adapted for the screen or something.
Yeah.
This is totally like a work of the imagination. And to my knowledge, doesn't come from any source material aside from the filmmakers' collaborative process together, right?
Yeah.
And that's very refreshing. Similar to, you know, we reviewed Coco a week ago or 2 weeks ago. Anyway, one of our previous episodes, Coco. And that's one of the things we talked about, was how refreshing it is to have an original story from Disney Pixar in that case, from Guillermo del Toro in this case.
Sí, señor.
Right? But all of the appreciation aside, and all of the whimsical, like, oh, it's like there's dreamlike and it's watery and it's fairy tale and everything, I would not recommend you bringing children to see this movie. Because yes, it is an adult fairy tale. The adult content, thankfully, is kept to a relative minimum, but it's like immediately put in your face within the first 2 minutes.
Yeah.
2.5 minutes of the film.
Yeah.
There's not super graphic nudity, but like there's, she's fully nude and then proceeds to please herself, in a bathtub, mm-hmm. you know, and granted you're not like super focused in on what's happening, but I mean that's within 2 or 2.5 minutes at the start of the film.
And you get the gist of it, even though it's out of
focus. This
really
like beautiful dreamlike opening with the voiceover and everything yeah. we talked about earlier, and then it's really jarring. I was really turned off by the shift of like,
yeah,
oh, this is like a fairy tale. Oh gosh, this is not like a fairy tale. I don't like this part at all. And then you ease back into the rest of her routine and the people that she knows and all of that, and it yeah. kind of gets better. But that kind of those punctuation moments happen more than once in the film. So fair warning, don't take kids. It's not that kind of fairy tale.
No.
It's definitely not like fully whimsical, childlike. Also, there's, you know, a fair amount of blood.
True.
And, you know, some
shooting and
yeah,
violence.
So
and
it's worth bearing in mind because yeah. it is hard to tell from the marketing campaign. I think it's hard to tell, you know, if this is, if it would be, you know, worth, you know, maybe a more mature minded kid, like a kid that understands adult concepts. Maybe I should take that kid to this movie. I would say probably not.
Yeah. And I agree. See, the thing with his films, they tend to skirt the line of realism and harsh reality, which is, you know, a point of fact in real life, you know, whether or not if you don't have a father and you have to go live with the man who now has married your mother and so forth, or however the story is unfolded. But it still seemed like a bit of excess for this film to go to the depths. Yes, it's a romance film. Yes, you have a woman who has feelings for something or someone that is foreign to the world that she's in. But to go as far as having to incorporate scenes with that where she's in the tub and whatever, and it's like it seemed too much. Like there's mm-hmm. there's a line that you create and you're like, okay, I understand she is equating love and that carnal nature with water, and
right.
there's a type of, you know, she you know makes them synonymous with each other, but to an extent where that has to be seen rather than it's kind of counterintuitive to the rest of the film in terms of creating beautiful cinematography where there's
right.
everything is speaking to you and there's not any language being said, but you're getting what's happening. That seems very counterintuitive to the rest of the film.
Yes. Yeah, it's just it you understand the narrative purpose and the storytelling purpose to an extent, but from the overall flow of how you as a viewer feel, I found those particular elements to be pretty jarring.
As well,
they felt like they didn't match the rest of the film.
Yeah. And as well, like there's another scene that, mind you, we didn't really, there's another scene with Michael Shannon
right.
and his mm-hmm. wife, and that's, you know, in terms of the, like the male dominant focused mindset that they were perpetuating with his character, you know, whatever. That was also another one that was just like, yeah, you know, I get it. He's, you know, the top dog. He's the king of the hill. I get it. I didn't have an issue so much with the violence because that tends to be more synonymous with his films prior to this one.
Right. Well, and it's not, it really isn't over the top. It's
no.
not. It's not Kill Bill or anything. It's not a Tarantino
oh, thank God.
Level of violence.
But yeah, it's sad to say that this film kind of removes you from the overall narrative and focus of the film because of doing one thing. And it's a big thing. I mean, it's not like it's a small, you know, scene. It happens twice in the film.
Right.
And then it's like, okay, you're almost kind of clenching back, hoping, okay, I get it. You don't have to, please don't do it a third time, please. But yeah, another thing, and this is more on the aspect of just consistency of the overall film.
Sure.
Another thing that kind of drew me out, there was a sequence where Eliza is thinking in her mind about, you know, she's wanting to translate something, and then it kind of jumps to a very out of film character type of scene where, and I know this might spoil a little bit, but she's doing like a show tunes type of thing, and she's beginning to sing,
right?
And it's like, that doesn't seem to fit. Like, I get it, they watch those types of movies, they're fans of that type, but just the way that whole scene kind of transpires, it kind of jumps from, all right, we are making a fairy tale that skirts the line of reality, to we're making a kind of Monty Python kind of scene that kind of looks a little ridiculous. But, I mean, you get it.
It's a bit of an interruption. And it's, honestly, I love that you're pointing it out, because it made me think of something that I hadn't realized watching the movie, but I wish that they would have shown more of her tap dancing.
That's true.
Because in her waking life, she tap dances sometimes. Mm-hmm. And she, with her neighbor friend, Richard Jenkins. They do a little like mini routine on the couch together for, you know, 20 seconds or something. It's nothing long. It's not like La La Land, like a dance sequence or anything. But it's fun. It's whimsical.
It is.
It shows personality. It shows creativity.
Yeah.
And I really, now that you bring up that whole dream sequence where she's dancing and singing and the creature is also dancing with her and whatever.
Yeah.
It's a shame that they didn't do a little bit more of that
in the reality.
Whimsical, like as she's walking down the street to get on the bus or something.
Yeah.
Or even sitting on the seat in the bus, or, you know, whatever it is. Just some more small touches, because it was really there in the first third of the movie, mm-hmm. two or three times,
oh, and yeah.
Then it was totally abandoned, even though arguably she was realizing some of the life experiences that she had dreamed about having and thought she never would.
Yeah.
Later on, but she's not, it's only in the dream sequence that she's having that dancey kind of heartwarming expression. She smiles quite a bit, you know, while she's walking or riding the bus or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Or mopping the floor as a cleaning woman in the facility, but yeah, the tap dancing, I would have liked to have seen a little bit more of that.
And
it was fun. It was a nice touch.
It really was. It was unique to the beginning, and I think it would have spoken more to the era that they were in and the world that she is in. You know, in her own bubble, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
It would have spoke more to that rather than it being this kind of odd sequence of events that occurs where, you know, like you said, that her and the monster dancing together. And I just thought that was, for me, really out of the full character of the film. And so
it makes you feel like you're watching a different movie than the movie you were just watching.
Yeah.
And then you return to the movie that you were originally watching. It's kind of an interruption.
It is.
It's nice. I mean, it's fun enough,
but all in all, Chad, what did you think of the film? Does it pass or fail, and how many monocles?
It's an interesting evaluation for me on this one, because I give it high marks for originality.
Mm-hmm.
And the creature design is exquisite.
Oh, yeah.
You can tell the amount of time and love that they put into making him look the way that he looks and be so believable.
Yeah.
You know, as a, like, prosthetics and makeup and costume physical creature. Some of the characters to me felt a bit flat.
Mm-hmm.
Caricatures rather than full characters.
Yeah.
Especially given the caliber of the performers. I thought that he and his team could have utilized somebody like Octavia Spencer, somebody like Michael Shannon, quite a lot better than they did.
Mm-hmm.
It was kind of painting by numbers a little bit with several of the characters for me. The visuals, high marks. The cinematography, super high marks.
Mm-hmm.
Some story elements, like we just talked about, I wasn't fond of. I would definitely give it a pass, because I think it's it's that uniqueness combined with the fact that it's really a throwback. I mean, it feels like a classic movie almost.
Yeah.
Minus some modern touches that I wasn't super fond of. But I would give it probably... How much to dock it? I'll give it 4. I think 4 is decently fair. I think it's better knowing ahead of time that some of that other content is in there so it doesn't catch you unawares. Because, again, honestly, I don't want to harp on it, but within the first 2 minutes, I was wondering, okay, wait a minute, how much of this movie is going to have that in it? Because I was really digging the stuff that they were doing before.
Yeah.
Like the French, you know, bistro music and the floating woman above the couch and whatever. That opening sequence that's very, it's got the fairy tale voiceover and all of that. Like, that was a really cool feel. And then you totally derailed it for about 20 seconds. And then you're trying to, like, get it back. And I was just sitting there for the first probably 10 minutes wondering, okay, so when is that thing going to happen again?
Yeah.
Because... that's always going to interrupt what I feel is the flow and flavor of the movie.
True. And as for me, I obviously the film passes. It was a really unique and special film. It really did bring back some of those feelings that I've talked about that I received when I saw Pan's Labyrinth for the first time. It does have a very whimsical and fairy tale-like feel to it. But the adult aspect was a little bit more in bold on this one. And there are scenes that you just can't overlook, unfortunately. It's sadly it's made to be a vital piece of the film because of what it represents. And for me, I think it's unnecessary to have it blatantly out there as opposed to alluding to it or you know, creating right. some type of other
There would
imagery.
Be a different way to execute that idea
exactly.
and not drop it entirely from the story than the way that they executed it.
Exactly.
In this film.
So, it passes for me. It does not surpass Pan's Labyrinth. I still think Pan's Labyrinth is one of his best films, hands down. And I would say I give it a 4. I think the music, I think the cinematography, mm-hmm. The performance of Sally Hawkins, Richard Jenkins, I think they do really well. Well enough job to create this feeling of, you know, this era. They really kind of create the era well enough that I actually enjoyed seeing them interact with each other on screen. And of course the Doug Jones, who does remarkable work as always. So yeah, I give it a 4 out of 5.
And I do, just to close out with a positive note, because I like doing that. Not that 4 out of 5 is a bad note, but I love that you brought up the music, because that opening French number is not the only, like, whimsical, fun musical selection. The soundtrack would be really fun to listen to.
Oh, yeah.
On its own, totally separate from the movie.
Oh, no doubt. But let us know what you think when you check out the film this Friday. Do you like it? Did you enjoy it? Did you not enjoy it? Let us know your thoughts on our Facebook page at facebook.com/filmlosophy or filmlosophers. And our Twitter page at twitter.com/philosophy101. Just to let you know, a couple of upcoming weekend releases. You have The Disaster Artist with James Franco.
Oddly enough, I cannot wait for that movie. And I don't know why. I've never wanted to see The Room.
Uh-huh.
But we're gonna.
That we are.
But I can't wait to see The Disaster Artist.
I'm excited for that one as well. Another film coming out this weekend is I, Tonya, which is the film about Tonya Harding, played by...
Margot Robbie.
Yes, sir.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, The Shape of Water, which is in limited release, so check to see if your local theater is playing it, and let us know what you think. So that about wraps up this show. It was a great conversation, and, of course, the filmmaker we could always talk about all the time, or at least I could.
Who is the filmmaker again?
Guillermo del Toro. Oh yeah, I Michael Buffered the heck out of that.
Man, that was like the voice of the Almighty.
So from all of us here at the Filmlosophers, I'm Eddie.
I'm Chad.
Class dismissed.